Welcome back to part 3 of Broad Appeal, Good, Bad, Crazy, Emma Thompson edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you, Brian?
Well, Sean, I'm feeling in a bit of a bubbly, anarchic mood, and it's mostly because of the film that we just watched, The Tall Guy.
Yeah?
Shawnee, the last time on this podcast, it seems like ages ago, when I convinced you, I twisted your arm to watch a relatively random early career Emma Thompson movie that I hadn't seen in a good number of years. The last time I did that, it was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, and it was only episode 2 of the podcast.
It was also only Emma Thompson's third film, I believe. Mm-hmm. That film was Dead Again. We don't need to revisit that one. We can leave it dead.
Dead forever.
Did you have any reservations when I suggested that for this final episode of the year, we look at Emma's film? Actually, I think that she made, presumably just before she made Dead Again.
Yeah, Dead Again was 91, I think, and this is 89.
Yeah, so who knows when all these things were filmed. Emma was clearly a rising star in the British filmmaking scene. Henry V was in there somewhere as well. But she had not yet made Howard's End. Maybe she'd been on Cheers? I'm not sure. Have I showed you that appearance that she has on Cheers?
Yes, I think actually that Cheers episode was 92, so she was already established at that point.
But before we get into what The Tall Guy is, could you just say something about who Emma is on Cheers?
Oh yeah, so she plays Frasier's first wife, and I always think it's interesting when sitcoms, you know, decree that someone has a first wife and is a first wife.
Or like a long-lost sister or cousin.
Yeah, because obviously Frasier has had two wives, Emma Thompson's character, whose name is
Nanny G.
Nanny G. And Lilith, of course.
Yeah, Nanny G, she's this, like, incredibly saccharine, popular children's singer who also is sexually rapacious and is coming to steal Frasier away from Lilith. The reason I bring this up is because I think for those of us who are introduced to Emma Thompson in E.M. Forster and Jane Austen adaptations and serious Best Actress nominated movies, then discovering that she had this like crazy comic career, which is sort of how she actually got her name, is a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
She also, her other famous sitcom appearance is playing herself on Ellen. Have I ever showed you that?
No, I was doing some Wikipedia-ing, as I am wont to do, and I saw that she had been on Ellen, but what was her role?
As herself, she plays
a
broadly comic version of Emma Thompson who has a big secret. And Ellen thinks that the big secret is that she's a lesbian. But actually, it's revealed at the end that Emma has an even bigger secret, which is that she's not British. She's actually from, like, Mobile, Alabama. And I learned the accent from watching Julie Andrews movies. Emma in Ellen, in Cheers, she's just really ready to send herself up. Like, I distinctly remember Ellen playing Emma's personal assistant says, "Oh no, you don't want to destroy your career by coming out as a lesbian American. I mean, think of all those Merchant Ivory movies. Dozens of people will be upset."
Did you watch Ellen?
I didn't watch Ellen, darling.
Did anyone watch Ellen?
People watched Ellen more once Ellen became a lesbian. No, I did not watch Ellen, but I will say to you that, of course, in the mid-1990s, if there was publicity that Emma Thompson was going to be on anything, not only did I watch it, I taped it. Yeah, yeah. I taped it. Okay, this is a long wind-up to talk about The Tall Guy. I got you to watch this movie. Did you have high hopes? Were the expectations met?
Yes and yes, because there's a very specific type of 1980s British comedy that I can really get behind, which is that kind of very cluttered-looking, quite anarchic, very silly, slightly surreal, just like meaningless, almost, humor. And I knew this was that kind of film, and I really got behind it, but also because years ago, Channel 4 had done something like 100 Greatest Sex Scenes in the Movies. Channel 4, Born Risky. And that was like number 97 or something.
What? So they picked 100 Greatest Sex Scenes, and this was only number 97?
Oh, I don't know,
what,
Brian.
What, was Sharon Stone in the Ice Pick number, you know,
I actually think
33?
A lot of them included sexual violence, so
yeah.
I don't know how we, you know, I think we need a bit of revisionist history for
those. Well, the sex scene in The Tall Guy actually contains a lot of violence as well, but it's completely consensual, comic, and fun.
Yeah, actually, the sex scene between Jeff Goldblum and Emma Thompson is one of the most joyous, fun, happy sex scenes you'll probably ever see in cinema.
This movie is entirely sex positive, and Emma's character is so fun, feminist, straightforward, horny, but also smart, and I'm sure we'll get to all that. I just want to briefly touch on what you're saying about 1980s British comedy and British filmmaking generally. I think whenever I return to British movies of this period, I'm always pleasantly surprised. They have a kind of raffish quality that seems like they were made on a relative shoestring compared to, like, their Hollywood counterparts, you know, like Out of Africa and these sorts of things. If you compare the early Stephen Frears films, like Prick Up Your Ears and My Beautiful Laundrette, they're just so fun. They feel like they've been made with tongue-in-cheek or with social realism, the kind of early Mike Lee. I think this probably has something to do with Thatcherite Britain, right?
Well, I think so, yeah.
So you have these kind of, you know, liberal, fun comic types, like, puttering away on the margins of British life. The mainstream discourse is dominated by Margaret Thatcher and Andrew Lloyd Webber, who is a very big presence looming over the Tall Guy.
He's a conservative peer as well.
And then as soon as Tony Blair and New Labour is ushered in, then the various Brit filmmakers like Richard Curtis, they're suddenly accepted as mainstream, and you get idiotic pablum like Love Actually, which is probably the apotheosis of dreadful New Labour comedy.
I know, yeah. And obviously as a Labour voter, that doesn't really leave a good taste in my mouth.
No, well, darling, we know that you're a Corbynista.
No, I'm more of a Thornberryan.
You're a Thornberryan, are you?
Yeah.
Yes, you and all the other descamisados.
Yes.
But anyway, so I've already invoked the name of Richard Curtis, and it is perhaps shocking and completely inequitable that our last movie was written by Richard Curtis, and we hated it. This movie is also written by Richard Curtis. It also has Emma. It also has Rowan Atkinson. I mean, there's a real sort of chain of, basically, of these last three movies that we've watched, so many of the same people have been involved in them in one way or another, acting, writing, directing.
Yeah, more so than any other triad of films that we've looked at in this series, or probably in the entire pantheon of broad appeal, have we seen so many repeat players. Interesting combination, though, like, quite different tonally and narrative-wise and everything, really.
I don't know lots about how Richard Curtis came into prominence. I can only imagine that he emerged out of the comedy scene or sketch or something.
Well, yes, Richard Curtis was heavily involved in things like Blackadder, and I know that Emma was involved in the comic strip Presents. Lots of sketch comedy, lots of BBC sitcom. Obviously, because so much of it was being produced in-house, a lot of the same people were involved, and Britain being smaller than America with fewer channels, more people kind of doubled up in these things.
So do you think this was like Richard Curtis's big break to, like, write a feature film? He didn't direct it. It's directed by somebody named Mel Smith.
Actually, no, Mel Smith, as far as I know, is also a comedian. It's interesting because the very first film Richard Curtis did direct was Love Actually, which was 14 years later.
Yeah. So, but he had an incredible run as a screenwriter with some big hits. This movie, first of all, would we recommend people to watch The Tall Guy? I know we're going to get into detail, but is it a thumbs up, Mr. Ebert?
Yeah, it's absolutely a thumbs up. I think we really both enjoyed it. It's not taxing. It's also, you get a particular snapshot, like with all period pieces, I suppose you could say, gives you a snapshot of a time and a humor. And I think importantly for you and me, we got something really nice out of this, because there's so many scenes of Jeff Goldblum cycling around London, central London especially, and the amount of times that Brian and I have cycled down the same roads that he cycled on, like cycled past the same people, locked our bikes in certain places. You must have this with the New York films a bit more. But there is something about seeing a place that is so familiar to you and being like, oh my god, I parked my bike there like 3 days ago. But also because I really love cycling in central London. I don't know, I never asked you this, but there's something really fun about like cycling down Shaftesbury Avenue. Just knowing where you are and knowing what's
hoping
around
you. Hoping you won't get hit by a bus.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, there's all the time where I would do a U-turn on Shaftesbury Avenue and be like, I'm really enjoying this.
I might die, but at least I'll die in the West End. You know, I agree with you that, it, like, seeing movies that have been filmed on a location in a city you know well is one of the kicks of life, of the life of a cinephile. Somehow I don't often get it in New York movies because, you know, I think oftentimes New York movies use locations that you can't particularly claim ownership of because they're so well known. Mm. It's when it's like that random episode of Damages that happens to have Glenn Close walking down the exact street in Park Slope that's around the corner from where you live. Or
you're talking from experience.
I am indeed talking in experience. Or how, I've said this before, Stockard Channing shows up at the old Waverly Movie Theater, which is now the IFC Center. It's the more sort of obscure locations that you love. I also ought to remind you of the excitement I had in Spotlight when Mark Ruffalo runs into the courthouse to get the documents, and I was like, that's where my dad used to work.
And what about that part where he's like, don't go down Dot Ave?
Basically, movies set in Boston, the real authenticity comes from discussions of traffic. Yeah, don't take Dot Ave, and then in Manchester by the Sea, the debate about how long it takes to get from Quincy to Manchester because of the traffic in Saugus. Anyone from Massachusetts knows the accuracy of those exchanges. But anyway, we are talking about London, and you're absolutely right, because one of the fun things is we do spend a good deal of time in central London, but this is central London in 1989. It's the West End. What shows are on the marquees when Jeff is cycling through?
So at the Palace Theatre, which is going to be showing Harry Potter and the Cursed Child forever and ever, is currently showing in this film Les Mis.
Yeah.
And I believe Follies is playing some
yes,
else as
the
well.
Cameron Mackintosh revival of Follies featuring Diana Rigg with the not so beloved song Ah But Underneath replacing the Ballad of Lucy and Jesse.
Because she can't dance.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny thinking about Jeff Goldblum's character in this movie because he's meant to be a kind of down-and-out actor type, and I think the fact that he cycles is definitely meant to be a character quirk,
yeah.
Whereas nowadays everyone in London seemingly cycles everywhere because transportation is so expensive.
There is something quite liberating about being on a bicycle, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
I always feel like I'm winning. You know what I mean? Hashtag winning. When I'm on a bicycle. Or I used to beat the bus home sometimes.
It's good unless there's a torrential downpour.
Yeah, of course. You're
I will also say there's one other location because although they cycle around central London, they seem to live in North London in Camden. Emma Thompson's character is a nurse at the Royal Free Hospital, which is near Hampstead. And there is a scene on a very famous bench.
Yeah, it's the Barbara Covert Memorial Bench.
Those who are familiar with the Notes on a Scandal episode, Jeff Goldblum, when he's feeling a little bit down, he sits there, but no crusty, manipulative lesbian comes by, because she wouldn't be interested in him anyway.
Well, she would be in the same universe, though, wouldn't she? She'd be teaching.
Yeah, I really want there to be, like, a crossover episode where Emma Thompson's character from this movie meets up with Sheba Hart and is just like, I'm sorry, you had sex with a 15-year-old. What are you thinking? Because no one does a what are you thinking scene better than Emma Thompson.
Yeah.
Okay, we've talked around and around this.
Let's go through the plot of this film really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Should
so
I do it?
Why is it called The Tall Guy?
Well, Jeff Goldblum is a tall guy.
But in the beginning of the movie, he has a job.
Yeah, so he has a job as this kind of straight man sidekick to a guy called Ron Anderson, who's played by Rowan Atkinson.
Notice the initials are the same.
It's very interesting. We find out gradually that he's been doing this role with Ron Anderson for years, years and years. And
what does the role consist of?
It just involves, like, being the fall guy, you know?
Yeah, like, literally getting whacked with an iron pipe.
Yeah, getting whacked with an iron pipe, falling down, but never really taking the laughs away from Ron, who's the star of the show. He is unlucky in love, and we get these little flashbacks of him with all the women he's been with who've made excuses not to be with him. We also get various different levels of, like, grooming of Jeff Goldblum with the little beard and his hair tied back and really quite sexy.
Is this the point where we have to pause and give you a little parenthesis to talk about your love of all kinds of Jeff Goldblum?
This is not a one-man fan club, Brian. I mean, have you heard of the internet?
I think so. Didn't Al Gore invent it?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so what, the internet loves Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah, the internet loves Jeff Goldblum, and Jeff Goldblum has just remained quite sexy as the years have gone on.
When was Jeff Goldblum at his sexiest?
Well, some people say that it's the scene in Jurassic Park where he's lying on the table with his shirt open.
Some people say, so, but what do you say?
Of course, I loved him in The Fly, although his perm was just a little bit too tight for me.
I remember there's some lean Goldblum muscle in The Fly.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum has that gorgeous body, and the reason he does, it's not like yours, Brian, really, he's dark and hairy, but he's muscular just enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he just is so fit. I mean, no wonder Gina Davis married him.
What was she thinking when she passed on that? Is he fit in this movie? There's not a
lot of
flesh being shown, though.
There's a couple of
bathrobe scenes where we see a bit of cleavage.
Yeah, and a shower scene.
Well, and then the sex scene, which we'll get to.
Oh, yeah, there's loads of naked.
Yeah, take it back. Okay, so obviously, he's unhappy professionally, he's unhappy in love. He lives in Camden in this kind of ramshackle North London house with a woman.
With many suitors.
Yeah. Do you want to explain that a bit?
You know, when I said earlier that everything is cluttered in the 1980s film, it's like a lot of thought has gone into the artistic direction of rubbish in the flat and clutter in his bedroom.
Yeah, it's the kind of shared house I think a lot of us are familiar with, where your flatmate has consumed almost all of the orange juice. You know, it's her decorating taste with this kind of weird fabric draped over everything. She has, like, a constantly rotating set of lovers that you have to deal with. And the gag in this movie is that she always has a new person she's sleeping with, and they're always completely buck naked.
Yeah.
So already you can see that this Richard Curtis movie has some of the elements that other Richard Curtis movies will have.
Yeah.
Four Weddings and a Funeral, I feel like, also has kooky, like, flatmate, best friend characters and all that kind of stuff.
Notting Hill has that scene with Risa Fans in his pants, which was quite prominent in the promotion.
Yeah, and, you know, like, the Bill Nighy character would fit right in from Love Actually would fit in with this. But I feel like the tone of this movie is quite divorced from the real world, like, even more so than your normal rom-com, right?
Yeah. Love Actually is just not based in any kind of semblance of reality.
No,
the real
but it's
world.
Based in the semblance of the kind of what we would say is, like, the glossy rom-com reality. Yeah. Like, everything's naturalistic, but there's a point in The Tall Guy where there's, like, a musical video interlude, and in one section, Jeff Goldblum's underwear grows a mouth and starts to sing.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of level. It's more Monty Python
kind of
thing, I guess, what I'm saying. So how does Emma come into the picture?
Jeff Goldblum has hay fever, and he goes to a doctor. He says he's terrified of needles, and he just does not want any injections, okay? As he's leaving the doctor's office, he sees this nurse pushing a man in a wheelchair, and in that moment, he just totally falls in love with her. He rushes back into the doctor and says, I changed my mind.
Give my daughter the shots.
Give my daughter the shots. And a few pricks never hurt anybody. And actually, when we were watching this, we identified that there's a clear trope in all Richard Curtis films.
Yeah.
Is of men who are so unable to talk to any woman that they will, like, humiliate themselves and put themselves through immense pain just to kind of get the courage to speak to her.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. So he comes back for a series of injections, of which he's only able to muster a hi and hello to her every time.
Yeah, and I think it was you who really identified that the inarticulate male is the Richard Curtis type.
Yeah,
it's played by Hugh Grant in Four Weddings.
Yeah, or Jeff Goldblum here.
Or all the many toxic, inarticulate men from Love Actually.
Yeah.
Emma pops up. She's in, like, really sort of traditional, old-school nurse's outfit, right? Like, with the little hat and, like, the kind of knee-length skirt. I don't know if nurses in 1989 really dressed that way.
I know. I wonder, too.
How would you describe Emma as the nurse, whose name is Kate? We kind of get introduced to her gradually, because obviously he keeps coming back for these injections. How is she at the start?
Well, she's kind of distant and reluctant and not really engaged with him.
I mean, I would call her no-nonsense,
yeah,
right? Like,
she's no-nonsense, but she also kind of doesn't really pay that much attention to him.
Well, she's there to do a job, which is to give him injections. She's like, all right, this is going to hurt. Now, there you go, come back in a week. And then she leaves. She's very professional, she's very courteous. What I love about Emma's character early in the film is that if she thinks something, she says it.
Yeah.
She says it straightforwardly. And this is why the Emma Thompson character is the exact opposite of this Richard Curtis male. Like,
mm-hmm.
he just wants to say, can I ask you out to dinner? And, you know, she's just waiting for him to say anything, and if he's not going to, she's just going to give him the shot and send him on his way. Eventually, he's gone through his series of hay fever injections, and then he comes up with his excuse for why he needs more injections, because he's off on a trip to Morocco.
Morocco?
That's right.
Why do you want to go there?
Why? Well, she's lots of reasons. I think Joe Orton used to go there to pick up little boys. Of course, that's not why I'm going there. I hate little boys. Well, not hate them. I mean, just don't feel very strongly about them. I believe the climate is excellent. Very good linen goods. They have a festival, I think, around this time of the year. Colorful costumes, that kind of thing.
When are you off?
Oh, not for quite a while. As long as it takes for us to get this series of shots done.
Oh, it's not really a series. I can give you all five today.
Five? Today? Not come back.
Mm-hmm. It would be six, but polio's just a sugar lump now. And then there's gamma globulin, tetanus, cholera, typhoid and TB. And at the moment, we're recommending yellow fever as well.
Oh, that would be six then.
Now, which arm don't you need?
Basically, then at a certain point, Jeff comes up with the brilliant line. He's like, well, could I take you out to dinner? And she's like, and why would you want to do that? And he says, well, I'm considering becoming a nurse, and I wanted to ask you questions about it. And this is like why I have no idea if Emma was involved at all in shaping this character, but it is just so perfect for her.
But actually, this is very well written, is what I have to say, in this regard.
She responds, again, matter-of-factly and directly. She says something like, so you want to talk to me about nursing? Well, if you wanted to have dinner with me because you thought I was nice or pretty, I'd certainly have done it. But if it's going to be nothing more than professional chat, I have enough nursing at work, thank you very much. And then, of course, he does admit that he's interested in her because she's nice and pretty. And this basically, you know, initiates the middle part of the movie, which is their absolutely delightful love affair.
Yeah. So basically, he meets her to go to dinner, and she says she's too tired, she'd rather go home. So he walks her home. They get to her flat, and she says, you know, don't expect that I'm the kind of type of girl who you can bring for dinner once and then go to bed with, because actually I'm the opposite. I'd much rather go to bed with you now than waste 10 expensive dinners to find out that we don't get on. And it is like, I know I've been slandering Richard Curtis and the lines of dialogue that some characters say, but like, I was just listening to this and thinking, oh my god, this is like nearly 30 years ago, and I find this way too refreshing. This is not good.
I mean, but where do we get from this Emma Thompson sex-positive, fun nurse character to, like, poor Laura Linney, who cannot integrate sex into her life because of her brother?
But, you know, they say the older you get, the more conservative you become.
The more money you make.
Yeah, and also, money tends to make people conservative because they don't want to give it away.
When we start to learn about her character's life outside of her nurse's uniform, she actually has some quirks of her own. First of all, we haven't given her full name. So what is Nurse Kate's surname?
Kate Lemon.
Kate Lemon. She said, oh, I've never liked that name. It's a horrid name. And Jeff Goldblum says,
oh, it could be worse. You could be called Hitler or Tampon.
I think it was that line, Sean. Honestly, I have to be truthful here, I think you were a little bit disengaged at the beginning of the movie, but as soon as Jeff Goldblum said tampon, I feel like you really clicked into this film's comic sensibility. Am I right? I did.
Am I right? I did a proper belly laugh.
What are Emma's domestic quirks? He comes over to her house for a mid-afternoon bonk fest.
Yeah, it's a pure hookup.
He comes over and she, you know, he's saying, oh, I'm just ready to chat. And she's like, well, let's get right down to it. And this is where this famous sex scene comes in. Now, I think people who haven't seen The Tall Guy, like all those people who watch that 100 Greatest Sex Scenes, that they know it mostly for this scene. Do you want to just describe what happens in it?
So Emma lives in another cluttered flat. You can tell that Marie Kondo's, mantra of minimalist living has not quite been written yet.
Spark joy.
Yes, lean in and spark joy.
Squad goals.
So then she and Jeff begin to get a bit hot and heavy under the duvets, and it immediately features this wonderful suggested scene of Grace, you know, going down on her.
That's the first thing you see.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrific, you know? So he sneezes on her because the downy feathers of her duvet are making him, you know, he has allergies. So then she chucks it out the window and they go at it. And they go at it in the most comical kind of way. It's like, there's cereal bowls, there's toast, there's milk cartons.
Gets his head stuck in a teapot at one point that he smashes on his head.
It's like every pile that's been piled up too high gets knocked down because they're bonking.
They bang on the piano.
Yeah, picture frames fall off the wall. We see Emma's lovely breasts. Do we see all of his butt?
We see both of their butts. I mean, it's nominally the character's butts. I don't know if it's the real actor's butts.
I hope it is.
They're very firm, both of them.
It's like, why would you show your tits and then not show your butt? That's
what
I want to know.
Who knows, Sean? I think one of the things I love about the scene, in addition to its comic uproariousness, is that it's basically showing that even athletic, crazy sex that involves banging someone's head on a piano can be incredibly pleasurable.
Yeah.
Because the last shot, if I remember correctly, Emma is up against the wall. I think Jeff is yet again going down on her, and her face is just full of complete and utter joy.
Yeah.
And it's just like this straight-laced nurse character who has been so professional giving the injections and actually, frankly, really cares about her job as a nurse because she's always working long hours. She also just really loves a good fuck.
It sure reminds me of a friend of mine.
Who may or may not listen to this podcast. Emma, I have to say, like, if you were a 1989 audience member who stumbled along to this little British comedy and had no idea who Emma Thompson was, Sean, would you or would you not fall in love with this woman?
Oh my god, I mean, it's like, she has star wattage coming out of, you know, the wazoo.
She is funny, she is sexy, she's approachable, she's intelligent.
She has heart, she has pathos.
She has great fashion sense. Can you describe both her hair and her outfit?
First of all, I love anyone with short hair. And all of her outfits I would just wear. I would wear all of them.
She has a few sartorial quirks.
Yeah, like she loves green and orange.
Orange particularly.
She has some great shapeless shirts that I could just see myself, you know, smothered in. Great hats and dresses. And even Jeff has such a wonderful style. Oh my god, I was so covetous. This is the late 80s, so it's kind of like veering into the early 90s, so I like that particular period.
So once this relationship kicks off in this particular afternoon fuckfest, actually kicks the plot into gear as well, because it causes some problems for poor Jeff with his job.
Well, he gets fired from his Ron Anderson show because he misses it because he's bonking for too long.
Yeah.
And then begins a quest for him to find a new employment, because as Emma says, you know, there's one thing about going out with an actor, she doesn't want to go out with an unemployed actor just for greater insult.
And the movie really takes a different turn here, where suddenly, in addition to this wacky rom-com, it also becomes a parody of 1980s British theatre.
Very much so.
It feels really insidery, both to an enjoyable and perhaps annoying degree at times. Like, there are very funny scenes that if you've ever been involved in the theater or been in a play, you will love. Jeff showing up at his agent's, who's passing out scripts to the other actors, and they're getting, like, Tom Stoppard plays and Steven Spielberg, and she's offering Jeff Goldblum, like, advertisements for Shake It Back.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, what kind of roles are there in London for a tall American? I was playing Abe Lincoln in a series of advertisements for muffins. But Emma is insistent. She says, you've got to get out there and get work. So eventually, he learns that the RSC is developing a new property, which is not a Shakespeare play, is it, Sean, but something else?
No, it's a musical adaptation of The Elephant Man called Elephant. You can hear the exclamation point at the end of my words there.
We have probably, if we're familiar with The Simpsons, we're used to this idea of taking, you know, some property that shouldn't be turned into a musical and turning it into a poor parody of a musical.
Yeah, like Streetcar.
Yeah, so we get quite a lot of scenes of this Elephant Man musical. How did you think it was in the spectrum of musical parodies?
I thought it looked quite good.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful parody of I Don't Know How to Love Him.
Yeah, so basically we should say this. At one point, when Jeff hears that it's an Elephant Man musical, he's like, that's an absolutely stupid idea. It's even stupider than Jesus Christ Superstar. And the agent said, well, yes, darling, Jesus Christ Superstar was a stupid idea. So it's very, very clear that this thing is meant to be a representation of the Andrew Lloyd Webber, Boobiel and Schoenberg, Les Mis type 80s British mega musical, yeah. Right? That is particularly what they're parodying. And that makes it, I think, very period and culturally specific.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
The I Don't Know How to Love Him is quite funny. So it's this woman who's the leading lady in the show. Basically, Jeff gets cast as the Elephant Man himself. They say that he has the exact right combination of awkwardness and vulnerability that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And he's in this, like, ridiculous prosthesis. We hear the ballad that this woman sings, and it's something like, rather than I Don't Know How to Love Him, it's like, I don't know how to reach him. He's always so distant, like a priest or a monk. And every time I get near him, he's packing his trunk.
Well, that song seemed to make an impact on you, Brian, if you could just recall the lyrics.
I did write down the lyrics. I think to anyone who has a knowledge of these types of musicals, there are some very, very astute little observations. Like, the very opening lines of the musical, the chorus is wandering through the foggy pea soup streets of London. There's fog machines going, and the first lines that they sing are, Requiem Aeternam.
Well, isn't that a direct reference to Amadeus?
Amadeus, also Evita. So I think the problem with those British mega musicals is they're all too frickin' serious.
I say on this podcast often, very po-faced.
So, of course, the end of The Elephant Man is a brilliant parody of the end of Les Mis, where the Elephant Man is dying in a bed that starts to levitate. And this is where, like, again, you have to be like, okay, this woman I've never heard of, Emma Thompson, is both really attractive, insanely intelligent, very funny. She's also a really good actress. And why I say this is because as Jeff is rehearsing his role in this musical, Emma is taking on that familiar part of the plus one girlfriend,
yes.
Right?
Well, we've all been there.
We've all been there. Do you want to just describe, like, what she's doing to help him and some of her developing insecurities?
Well, you know, first of all, she's being the very supportive spouse, and she's helping him with his lines. She's fretting about what she's going to wear to the opening night party. You know, she's thinking about, you know, who she's going to talk to. They're both dreaming about his increased fame and success. So, you know, and she's also being a full-time care provider.
Yeah, she even shows up at the opening night party in an ambulance.
Yeah, I love that part. It's like they drive her and then the back door's open and she just hops out in a lovely little dress.
Yeah, it's a kind of like black tulle dress, but with obviously the orange accents, because orange is Nurse Lemon's color.
I love orange myself.
I know.
Yeah.
Basically, if you're thinking to yourself, gosh, this movie doesn't seem to have a lot of conflict or a lot of plot, that is definitely true. And at this point, a slightly manufactured conflict kind of comes into it.
Yeah, so we should probably just tell them what happens and then they can watch the rest themselves. And then comes the conflict, which occupies the film until its obvious happy resolution. Jeff, and I should point out, he has a character name, which is Dexter King. He gets with one of the insipid cast members.
She's sort of like a British version of Bernadette Peters.
That is entirely correct, Brian.
This movie, I think, came out pretty much around the same time as Slaves of New York, and the fashions have something in common with that movie as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you find this bit believable? Because basically, this actress, like, comes on to him really hardcore.
Well, actually, I found that part to be kind of boring and tedious. But what I did care, and we can tell the listeners this part, is how Emma responds to it, or how she deduces that it's happening. And actually, actually, I really liked this.
Yeah, again, you're totally blindsided by the fact that in this crazy movie where there's, like, singing underwear and people getting hit in the head with a lead pipe, suddenly Emma gives us a masterclass in honest, rounded human emotion, because they've come home from the opening night party. She says to him, "I'm packing my bag," and he's completely surprised as to why, and it's because she's intuited exactly that he's having an affair with his leading lady.
Yeah, I thought it was such an interesting observation that I have to be very careful not to replicate in my own life. Whenever he says her name, he would pause afterwards. So he'd be like, "I know there was John and Tom and Kevin and Cheryl and Mike." And I thought, oh my god, that's so good.
She also notices that when he pours her champagne at the opening night party, neither of them make eye contact with one another.
I think that was really interesting too.
Yeah, you see this kind of seed of Emma's ability to do so many things that she will go on to do in so many movies, which is to be intelligent and emotional at the same time, and to crucially tell clueless men what they have not seen. Do you not see? I mean, I just feel like the ultimate Emma line is, "Do you not see?" And I can't believe that we've gotten so far without me saying, "You had a mistress and I forgave you. My sister has a lover and you drive her from the house."
I'm sure you said that in episode 2. I'm sure you did.
But whether it's Anthony Hopkins, whether it's Kenneth Branagh, whether it's Jeff Goldblum or Alan Rickman, Emma Thompson is exactly the kind of woman that you want telling men that they haven't been paying attention, they haven't been good enough. And this is why, basically, I think the Hollywood studios and Congress and Parliament, they should just appoint something called the Thompson Commission, which should be to investigate, you know, abuse of power by men, and it should be headed by Emma Thompson.
I'm all for it.
She'd just deliver these searing, sensible, but forceful monologues telling men all the ways in which they've just not been up to snuff, and it would be incredible.
Yeah.
I know, Sean, you don't necessarily want to spoil the end of The Tall Guy. It's funny, because usually we go all the way through to the end in describing the plot.
I know, but it's a romantic comedy, so you know that they kind of get back together again. And I actually kind of encourage you just to go and seek it out.
We'll just say that it ends up with a kind of mad car chase. There's some fun at the hospital. And what I love is, like, all the way through this, Emma is still being a nurse. Like, the conclusion that sort of brings them back together also involves her medical work. It is charming. It's a very slight film. I'm not sure that it's right up there with the great comedies of all time.
Yeah, it is not, but there's nothing wrong with being a slight film. There's nothing wrong with film just being mildly anarchic and pure fun.
Yeah, it's a fun movie that I think is made, in my mind, far more memorable because of this amazing creation of a truly new type of female romantic comedy heroine. I mean, in the way that Annie Hall signaled a new type of love interest when Diane Keaton took on that role. Maybe Meg Ryan was a particular type, you know, in When Harry Met Sally. I really think Emma Thompson here is every nerdy, brainy boy's dream girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And every woman's dream girl. She's basically everyone's ideal human. Like, who would not want to be Emma Thompson or be friends with Emma Thompson?
No. Emma, if you're listening, please call us. Tweet at Broad Appeal Pod. Or her individual Twitter handles. I'm at Sean McGovern next and he's at BA Mullen Speaks. Please.
Maybe that's Sean's way of saying that these episodes have gone on long enough, but...
No, before we finish, something I just can't let go. It's time for Can't Let It Go. There's that a wonderful musical montage scene featuring Suggs from Madness singing It Must Be Love. The one truly offensive part of this film is that when Emma comes to clean up Dexter's flat to, like, help him, there's a Madonna True Blue framed mirror poster which she takes off the wall, and then we see it smashing in the trash, and I said to Brian, that is offensive when we were watching it.
I have no idea what Emma Thompson's actual opinions on Madonna are. We'll have to conduct an inquiry. Something tells me they'd get along. Come on.
I'm sure they've met.
They probably have. I'd love to see them on a talk show together.
I would love to see them exchanging their theories on feminism and environmentalism.
Yeah, maybe their theories on Wallace Simpson.
I would like to see Emma Thompson call out Madonna for her fascist tendencies.
Mm. So, Shawnee, we have done a deep dive into the wonderful world of Emma. It's been a delightful Christmas experience for me. How about for you?
Oh, it's been great. It's been wonderful. Like, I always loved her. You know, 4 years with you, of course I love her more, because that's absolutely non-negotiable.
Sink the Belgrano.
Do it.
I always thought to myself, wouldn't the Iron Lady be better if Emma had taken on the Margaret Thatcher role? Because here's the thing. Okay, being an
pause.
Actual... What?
Wouldn't the Iron Lady be better if it had a script?
But here's the thing. Meryl, for all her liberal bona fides, I think basically turned Margaret Thatcher into two entities. She was either a drag queen cartoon, or she was sort of a weird feminist saint. And I think the thing about Emma, you know, being a young woman in Thatcherite Britain, she would have understood that Margaret Thatcher, while a, quote, trailblazing woman for the role she took on, was a complicated and sort of anti-feminist type. And there is probably an amazing Margaret Thatcher biopic yet to be made. Sadly, I don't think it ever will be.
Do you know what that actually needs? It needs like an OJ Made in America Vietnam War style documentary. Really? Yeah.
Documentary or miniseries?
No, like documentary miniseries.
Which?
I've created something.
But you mean, is it fiction or nonfiction?
No, it's nonfiction. So
it's nonfiction, so yeah. It has nothing to do with Emma Thompson.
No, Emma Thompson can be like a talking head.
Just like, you know, we brought in this actress to talk about politics.
No, really, I'm serious.
Maybe she could narrate it.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be good.
Quickly, cast Emma Thompson in some biopics. Go.
Okay. Oh, how about this? What about a biopic of the woman who created Mary Poppins? That would be good.
Surely Emma has a lot more wonderful roles in her. I'm hoping for a later in life resurgence.
Well, we have the Children Act, which was at Toronto this year, but is being kept until April next year. I wonder about that release date. I'm curious.
Well, I'm excited by the idea of Emma and Stanley Tucci, because it's a little bit of Emma encroaching into Meryl territory.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're not going to end on a note of conflict. Instead, we're going to say this. Thank you to all our listeners, new and old. You've helped us get through a difficult year, 2017. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
Sean, you know, we started this year reading all sorts of novels and turning them into movies. We've now got through Good, Bad, and Crazy on 6 different actresses. It's been quite a year of expansion here at Broad Appeal.
Yes, and can you believe we only started that last season at the start of this year?
This is what I'm saying. It's been 12 months of unrelenting work. I think we've earned a break.
Yeah, so dear listeners, we are taking a break for a while, at least for 2 months.
Yeah, we've had a good run. We've had a good run. But what we're doing now is...
We're sure you've enjoyed us.
We're going to take a hiatus, but we will not be turning away from the movies. Obviously, Oscar season is heating up, so while we are out of your earbuds, we are going to be trying to catch a lot of the female Oscar contenders, and we will be returning probably at some point in February, I imagine.
Yeah, February for the Oscar episode.
Yeah, you'll get an Oscar episode from us after the nominations come out, and we've gotten a chance to see all the ladies, and we will return with brand new actress-centered episodes at some point after that in the new year.
Yeah, we should say that we're continuing the series of Good, Bad, Crazy for 6 more episodes.
He said it, so I guess we now have to do it. Until that time, enjoy your Christmas presents, burn all copies of Love Actually, read a bit of Jane Austen, chain yourself to an iceberg. Anything else they should do?
Vote.
Yes, go out and vote, especially if you live in a red state.
Yes.
Thanks. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa.
Nolikona Yiv.
Yeah. Goodbye, shalom, and peace on earth.
Bye-bye.
I've got to go to work.
Oh, wait a minute, I'll keep you company.
Okay.
How long have I got?
About 12 seconds.